This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Nellie Mackay is a young singer, songwriter, and performer whose career path, while still in its early stages, has been defiantly non-traditional. Musically, her songs draw on everything from jazz and pop to cabaret and hip-hop. Lyrically, she can be starkly honest or playfully silly. She appeared on Broadway in a revival of the Threepenny Opera opposite Alan Cumming and Cyndi Lauper, and once had dreams of being a jazz singer. And her new album, a collection of standards sung by one of her favorite singers, allows her to embrace her inner cabaret diva. It's called Normal as Blueberry Pie, a tribute to Doris Day. Here's a song from that CD, written by George and Ira Gershwin. Doris Day sang it in the film Tea for Two. It's called Do Do Do.
Oh, do, do, do what you done, done, done before. Baby, do, do, do what I do, do, do adore. Baby, let's try again, sigh again, fly again to heaven. Baby, see, it's ABC. You love me. I know, no, no, what a bo, bo, bo should do. Baby, so don't say it won't come true. Baby, my heart begins to hum. Dum, de, dum, de, dum, dum, dum. So do, do, do what you done before.
Nellie Mackay from her Doris Day tribute CD, Normal as Blueberry Pie. Nellie Mackay visited Terry Gross in the Fresh Air Studios in 2007 when her third album, Obligatory Villagers, was released. She brought her ukulele and opened with a song from that earlier CD.
Feminists don't have a sense of humor. Feminists just want to be alone. Spread vicious lies and rumor. They have a tumor on their funny bone. They say child molestation isn't funny. Ha! Rape and degradation's just a crime. Lighten up, ladies, rampant prostitution, sex for money. What's wrong with that? Can't these chicks do anything but whine? Dance break. Da 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 da. Yeah, take it off. Da da da. Isn't witty, it's hot. Equal work and wages worth the fight. Sing us a new one. On demand abortion, every city. Okay, but no gun control. Won't these women ever get a life? Feminists don't have a sense of humor. Poor Hillary. Mine a Big Mac. Feminists spread vicious lies and rumor. They're far too sensitive to ever be a ham. That's why these feminists just need to find a man. Da, 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 da,
da. Oh, bravo, that was great. That's really fun. That song kind of sums up just some of the things I like about you. I mean, it's really funny and trenchant, and you have a beautiful voice, and you're singing about a very contemporary set of themes here, But the style of music that you're playing, I mean, it was almost vaudevillian, like tap dancing. So you're bringing together these different eras musically and lyrically.
Oh, well, thank you. I think there are nice things about every era. I wish we could just take the nice things.
Now, in the song we just heard about feminism, I mean, do you consider yourself a feminist?
Well, yes, but I also know I'm a hypocrite, but not just in regards to feminism, in regards to everything. I think that's, it's unavoidable, but at the same time, you try your best to reconcile your belief system with your actions.
What makes you a hypocrite? A hypocrite in terms of feminism?
A hypocrite. I like a
hypocrite. Yes.
Yeah. It's that political ideal and the personal reality. For instance, even having a career, and being ambitious in that way is kind of, it's a capitalist ethos. It's not a all for all mentality. There's a lot of me there, and maybe you want to be big so then you can spread your communist message. But that in itself is a contradiction.
There's something like so sweet about some of the standards from, say, like the 20s and 30s. And you wrote a song that was on your first album that's kind of in the manner of those songs about, getting married, having a little white house at the end of Honeymoon Lane, that kind of song. But your version of it is all of the things that have become cliches and for you probably undesirable in some way, or at least that version of it is undesirable. And the song I'm thinking of, I think I've not done a very good job of describing it, but the song I'm thinking of is I Want to Get Married, it just seems to me like your take on a certain kind of standard that you don't feel like you could really sing honestly.
Oh, no. I'm sure I will fall again and be able to sing them honestly again. But at this moment, there's a certain breeziness that preempts a maudlin rendition. Well, I've been doing very maudlin renditions, but now I'm breezy. I'm like Ellen DeGeneres when she talks about walking around in a hospital gown. I'm flap, flap, flapping in the breeze.
Do you want to do a few bars if I want to get married?
Yes. Yes, I need a spouse. I want a nice leave it to beaverish golden retriever and a little white house. I want to get married. I need to cook meals. To pack cute little lunches for my Brady Bunches, then read Daniel Steele. I wanna escape this red race I've created. I'm feeling enervated. I don't care if I make it. Just want to bake a sugar cake for you to take to work in the morn. And I'll stay home cleaning the dishes and keeping your wishes all warm.
Nellie Mackay, what were you thinking when you wrote the song? What were you thinking about?
Well, it was lament. I wanted to get married, I realize no matter what you want, it's kind of a fantasy.
So my take on it was all wrong. It wasn't your shout out and critique of standards from the 20s and 30s.
No. But I mean, you can criticize something you strive for, and you can avoid something you dream about. You're mean to me. Why must you be mean to me? Gee, honey, it seems to me you love to see me crying. I don't know why I stay home each night when you say you phone. You don't and I'm left alone, singing the blues and sighing. You treat me coldly each day of the year. You always scold me whenever somebody is near, dear. It must be great fun to be mean to me. You shouldn't, for can't you see what you mean to me?
Now, you were born in London, moved to New York when you were two with your mother after your parents separated, but you spent your high school years in the Poconos. There's a really interesting jazz scene there. Phil Woods lives there, Bob Dureau, the singer-songwriter and pianist, and a whole bunch of other musicians. And Bob Dureau is on your new CD. Were you, as a teenager, did you know the people in that scene from there?
I did. I used to bug them when I was in high school, and now I've come back to underpay them. So I think they're all grateful to have made my acquaintance. And they're just a bunch of pussycats.
So when you were in high school and you knew Phil Woods and you knew Bob Dureau, were you thinking then that you would be a jazz singer? Were you thinking then that you'd be writing your own songs?
No, I've always looked for the easy way out, and singing other people's songs seems easier. But it just didn't happen for me. So we're stuck here in this cesspool of bad poetry.
It seems to me you have like a really pretty voice, but in your songs you usually don't want to be pretty. I mean, you're often saying pretty cutting things in your lyrics. I think it's just a really interesting paradox of who you are as a performer, that there's this like beauty in what you're capable of doing, which you sometimes intentionally undercut by what you sing about. I'm going to ask you to do a few bars of a song called Manhattan Avenue. This is also from your first album. And this is an example of what I mean. I mean, it sounds like really pretty, but if you listen to the lyrics, it's not so pretty. Can you tell the story behind the song before you play it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I had a lovely, childhood. But there, you still see a lot of things.
This is a period when you were living in New York City, I think in Harlem.
That's right, in Harlem. And, there was a lot of beauty there. The older people in the building, even they had some problems. I mean, Lionel, there's a man named Lionel in the song. He did kind of guard over the building, but he also eventually got evicted for having too many prostitutes in his apartment. We had some good friends in the building that we kept in touch with a while, and not much education, and you can see that in the Christmas cards, but that makes them all the more poignant, just when it's harder for them to do something, and yet they do a more beautiful job than people who have all the privilege in the world. We got a lot of our cats from the alley next door, and the older women, especially in our neighborhood, would put out food for the cats and for the pigeons, and yet largely the young men would sick their pit bulls on them, and my mother once saw a cat's throat torn out in front of her by a pit bull. And this was a cat we had, we were probably going to adopt. So a lot of mixed messages.
And you mentioned the pit bulls in this lovely melody. And this is Manhattan Avenue. Why don't you play it for us?
Send a breeze, a pit bull's yell, a tender squeeze, a cry for help. Make it now and make it fast. Such memories can never last. I long for the days, music and mayhem. Mama's a smiling friend in the scuzzy hue of the streetlight, Manhattan Avenue. Lionel, please, watch or outdoor. The children tease, I beg for more. Chip and paint, ceiling spent. Oh, ain't it great? Can't make the rent. I long for the days kittens are meowing, junkies are prowling deep in the jazzy hue of the streetlight, Manhattan Avenue. What strange vice that a mugger and a child should share the same paradise. Oh, but dreams come true on Manhattan Avenue.
That's Nellie McKay performing her song Manhattan Avenue. You mentioned a mugger in that last line. Is there a specific mugger that you're thinking of in that line?
Oh, I am. Yeah. I want to say hi to my mugger if I'm listening. If he's listening. I'm sorry. I want to say hello. I want to give a shout out because he only spent about, I think, a year in the joint, and then he got out and he was looking for us, but we were breaking down somewhere in South Dakota, so he couldn't get us again. Yeah, he came by and he said, "Give me the oop money or I'll oop the kid up." And we just laughed. We thought he was a friend of ours. And then he kept saying it. And then we figured out, oh, he wasn't a friend of ours. But then my mother, being as swift and ruthless as she is, she didn't even toss him her real wallet. She tossed him her dummy wallet. And then, and so all he got was $2 and a couple of bad credit cards that had no money on them anyway. And then he took off sauntering down the street. And my mom was yelling after him, "Yeah, you better run. You better run." I don't know if he did start to run. And then we got him in a lineup. But then we were beginning to think maybe it's time to leave New York.
Your mother carried around a dummy wallet for muggers?
Oh, yeah. But I think, for those listening, it's probably gone up from $2 now. you should always account for inflation.
Nellie McKay, visiting the Fresh Air Studios in 2007. Her new CD, a collection of standards, is called Normal as Blueberry Pie, a tribute to Doris Day. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Normal as blueberry pie, no more a smart little girl with no heart. I have found me a wonderful guy. I am in a conventional dither with a conventional star in my eye. And you will note there's a lump in my throat when I speak of that wonderful guy. I'm as tried and as gay as a daisy, and may a cliche coming true. I'm bromidic and bright as a moon, happy night pouring light. I'm a dude.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Norah Jones became an immediate star after the release of her 2002 album, Come Away With Me. Having sold over 36 million albums, Jones decided to move in a different direction with her fourth CD called The Fall. Rock critic Ken Tucker wonders whether that change is good.
Norah Jones's voice is refrigerator cool, never icy or frosty or drop-dead cold, which tends to make any song she sings seem both brisk and a little chilly. This is good for your average singer-songwriter, for whom the tendency to spill the warm blood of emotion needs a little contrast to keep from becoming humid and overwrought. But for Jones, cool distance was becoming a mannerism, a fetish. It was as though she was starting to take pride in seeming not engaged. On her new collection, The Fall, Jones sounds like someone who's decided to snap out of it, to approach new songs with more eagerness and alacrity.
I pretend my heart's not on fire if you steal. My true love's name broke down subway in the city of spires. Tape your picture over his in the frame. We'll imagine we're sleeping revolver shotgun wedding. In a strange soho, our chambers hold silver collars. Gun down werewolves wherever we go. Gun down werewolves wherever we go. Midnight phone calls.
So that song, Youngblood, is clearly not the 1957 Lieber and Stoller hit for the Coasters. Norah Jones is likely never to loosen up that much. But this new Youngblood, which she's co-written with Mike Martin, contains a few departures typical of her new album. Jones, who spent most of her recording career behind a piano, plays the guitar here and throughout this collection. And she's poking around for new metaphors for love and heartbreak, here imagining herself shooting a gun at werewolves and setting New York City aflame. No one's going to mistake Norah Jones for a rebel, but it's helped revitalize her gift for fashioning a sharp musical hook, as on the album's first single, Chasing Pirates.
In your message you said you were going to bed, but I'm not done with the night. So I stayed up and read, but your words in my head got me mixed up, so I turned out the light. And I don't know how to slow it down. My mind's racing from chasing.
The sound of this new album, The Fall, is both stark and spacious. Jones is working for the first time with the producer and engineer Jackeer King, who's also collaborated with Tom Waits and Kings of Leon, musicians who favor a louder, rougher sound than we associate with Norah Jones. King has designed an echoing sonic landscape where electric guitars and various drummers reverberate alongside Jones's voice. The freedom of these arrangements has freed Jones up to rock out, or at least come as close as Norah Jones will to rocking out.
If all we talk about is money, nothing will be funny, honey. Now that everyone's a critic, it's making my mascara running. If we only talk about the heavens, making it together is crazy. If we don't get we're lazy, but it's gonna be
Nora Jones is also something of a rueful joker, as when she salutes the man of the hour in a song of the same name. The song suggests that after too many rocky romances, she's found a perfect companion, a dog.
It's him or me, that's what he said. But I can't choose between a vegan and a pothead. So I chose you because you're sweet. And you give me lots of loving, and you eat meat. And that's how you became my only man of the hour. You never lie.
If in the end the fall is not quite as jaunty as the top hat Jones wears on the cover of this album, it's certainly an improvement over the dolorous self-regard of her last couple of albums. She's referred to this collection as an experiment. I don't think even the most conservative Nora Jones fan is going to find this experiment all that jarring. But it certainly opened up her voice to a new expressiveness that's not tidy or merely pretty.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed The Fall, the latest album from Nora Jones. Larry Sultan, a photographer from California who achieved fame both with his camera and as a conceptual collector of existing photos, died of cancer last Sunday. He was 63 years old. Sultan, working with Mike Mandel in the 70s, persuaded several giant corporations to allow access to their documentary photo files. 59 photos were selected, showing everything from a flaming car to a shaved monkey. They were published, without captions or other explanatory material, as found photos in a highly influential 1977 collection called Evidence. Sultan took pictures as well as hunted for them. For about a decade, he photographed his parents in various poses and combined those pictures with old family snapshots, reproduced stills from home movies, and memorabilia from his father's career. All of these images were collected in his book called Pictures from Home. Larry Sultan was working on that book and a related exhibition when Terry spoke with him in 1989 and asked him about the project.
Can you tell me about the range of emotions that you experienced looking back at pictures of your parents when they were young?
Boy, that's interesting because there's this phenomena where there's a double vision. All photographs, in a sense, are historical because the moment is gone. And so here I am looking at people who are actually younger than me and seeing that they had a life outside of me. You know, they're not only my parents, they had this independent existence, which is a fairly frightening notion, and it leads you to all kinds of speculation that one doesn't want to get into, you know, about their intimate life. And so that was an interesting thing, to see them independently, and then to also see, I think, the melancholy I felt around the aging process, how certainly the vitality of my parents, and I mean, it's inevitable, the body changes, it's not a sad phenomena as much as it is an opportunity to watch this transformation of the body through time.
Now, in addition to old photographs, you also have some old documents in your piece. Letters, for instance, welcoming your father into the Eversharp family when he started to sell razor blades. Why did you include some of these old documents, old business letters and things like that, and where did you find them?
Well, it was very important to include those because what I felt I was doing, and I think what I've done, is try to create a pattern of public life and private life, of family and business, of success and perhaps conflict within the family. And so my father's business documents, to me, they not only document his career, I think they really, in a way, indicate a time. I mean, welcome to the Eversharp family, and you're a team player, and I mean, it was this, the sense of the 50s that was so full of that optimism and so full of that hope that one would enter a family and be taken care of and be part of a team and be a team player and believe in the product and blah, blah, blah. You know, it goes on. And it's a phenomenal record, not only of that specific event in his life, but I think of a time that's no longer available to us. So that's interesting to me about how you can document a time through a very biographical, personal point of departure.
Now, you've had to take a lot of new photos of your parents for your project. Your parents, I'm sure, are used to smiling for photographs, and you tried to get candid shots. I think you, in fact, told them not to smile. What were their reactions to the kinds of photographs you wanted?
Well, you know, I became a real pain. I worked in this for 7 years, and I really strained my parents' generosity. In the beginning, I think it was, you know, I would follow them around. In fact, I went on vacation with them to Hawaii and photographed them. And then as they got more and more accustomed to me being around, I'd follow them into their bedroom. And after a while, they in terms of the daily photographs in which they weren't necessarily conscious or posing, although there's always somewhat of a pose, that was fine. I think the problem really occurred when we would set up a photograph, and some of the photographs are staged, and there was always this dilemma. My father has a standard, I think, successful businessman pose that he's been practicing for years. You know, this kind of steely looked and look him in the eye and rigid body. And in fact, I think he'd cock his head, looking off to the left into the future. And that's not what I wanted. And there was quite a disagreement about that. And in fact, part of the book is his response to my photographs and his response to the way I photograph and the way I represent him, which I think is a real crucial part of this work, because I have no, I wouldn't presume that I'm telling the truth. I'm telling my version of the truth, but it's not the objective version. There is no objective version.
Your father said to you that he doesn't like what you call introspection. When he sees one of those photos, he says, for the most part, that's not me I recognize in those photos.
Well, the side of my father that interests me the most is that vulnerable, introspective side. Now, that's not a side that comes out very often, and it's certainly not a side that one shows to the public. And perhaps, to be fair, there is a somewhat of a lost look in one of those photographs, and that was important to me. And maybe I'm being accurate to my point of view and not so accurate to him, so he could be right. Maybe that isn't him he recognizes. Maybe that's more me.
Did you say a lost look?
Yes, a look that has a taste of melancholy to it.
Let me describe a photo that I think is exactly that, or at least that's how I read it. And it's a photo of your father all dressed up in a dinner jacket, and it looks like he's probably on the way out. But he's sitting on the bed, just kind of looking off in this dinner jacket. And to me, it reads all dressed up for a kind of letdown.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that photo a lot.
Yeah, he hates it.
Really?
He absolutely
hates it. How come?
Well, because he says that... he created the analogy that it was like having doing a film and the actors are taking a break, and that's when you photograph them. And we were actually, I asked him to get dressed up, and we were doing he was writing on the wall for me, kind of a mock Dale Carnegie program, and he sat down on the bed just to rest. And you're right, it is all dressed up with nowhere to go in my mind. And that's an ideological photograph. It relates, in my point of view, to, I think, memory and one looking back on their life. Maybe most of the challenges have been in the past, at least in terms of one's business life. And so, yeah, it's taken out of context. It's a fiction.
Another photo I have to ask you about. There's a picture at the kitchen table in your parents' house. Your father is seated at the kitchen table, his eyeglasses are on the table, and I think he's entering something onto his calendar. And your mother has just come in, the grocery bag is on the table, and she's unpacking it. I recognize this photo. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I could say that a lot of the photos that you've taken. This seems to me the kind of shot that is almost a daily ritual, but it's not the kind of ritual we think of photographing.
Yeah. I mean, it's the daily thing that interests me. It's the familiar that I think is so phenomenally rich with innuendo and I guess the aroma of daily life. I think that that's where we live our life, right? We don't go out to these great huge events. We live our life, you know, walking up the street and coming in the house and setting down our coat and unpacking groceries. And that's the sight that I'm most interested in.
I want to quote something that you write toward the end here. You say, "Behind all the peering, the good pictures, the rows of film, and the anxiety of my project is the wish to take photography literally, to stop time. I want my parents to live forever." I think that's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. There was something that happened to me in the middle of this project that I think was very significant. And, you know, when I begin work, I have really no idea where I'm going to go, but I need to think that I know where I'm going to go. And so I invent all these notions that what I'm doing is sociological or whatever. And in the middle of this project, I had a photograph that I had made that was particularly moving to me. It was a close-up of my father as he was sleeping on a couch, taking a nap in Palm Springs. And I looked at the picture on my desk, and it struck me that there's a chance that this picture will outlive my father, that I'll be looking at this picture one day when perhaps he's not here. And it really changed my whole notion of what I was doing. I moved from the sociological drop way down to the sense that I was making pictures that came from, I think, a need to not only understand my parents, but to let them go in a certain fashion. Almost like an adolescent lets things go. I'm a late bloomer in that sense. So from that, of course, you know, photography does stop time. And it's an exterior form of memory. This existed. I mean, that's its greatest truth, is to leave a trace of what has been.
Larry Salton speaking to Terry Gross in 1989. The California photographer died Sunday at age 63. You can see three photographs Larry Salton took of his parents at our website, freshair.npr.org. The most anticipated movie of the year may be Avatar, the nearly $300 million epic from writer and director James Cameron. The director of Titanic and The Terminator spent years helping to develop digital 3D camera systems and has used them to create an entirely computer-generated world, Pandora, a lush moon in a nearby solar system. Film critic David Edelstein has returned from Pandora with this review.
As the budget of Avatar grew otherworldly and few saw footage, Hollywood watchers began to speculate that the new, largely computer-generated James Cameron movie would be a Titanic disaster. But they shouldn't have doubted him. That trademark Cameron blend of jaw-dropping technology, grandiosity, and cornball populism is back and mightier than ever. The film is dizzying, enveloping, vertigo-inducing. I ran out of celebratory adjectives an hour into its 161 minutes. Now, it's also on one level a crock, predictable, sentimental, and tin-eared. Cameron has given us a parable that's a barely disguised rewrite of American history. Native Americans, in the form of the blue, 10-foot Navi people of Pandora, a moon of the vast gas planet Polyphemus, battle expertly against white capitalist imperialists who want to drive them from their ancestral lands. The year is 2154, and a Marine named Jake Sully, played by the personable Sam Worthington, works for a military-industrial behemoth that's mining Pandora for a rare mineral called, get this, unobtainium. Jake has his nervous system projected into a remotely controlled Navi body called an avatar for the purposes of mingling with the natives. And it's when he's tall and blue that the film goes into full-scale computer mode. Back in the world of flesh and blood actors, a prickly scientist played by Sigourney Weaver, who totally holds her own against the 10-foot-tall blue thingies, wants Jake to study Na'vi rituals. She's funded by the company, but has a humanist agenda. But a selfish executive played by Giovanni Ribisi calls the Na'vi blue monkeys, and since their sacred land sits over a vast supply of unobtainium, he wants Jake to convince the tribe to decamp. Jake has to keep a video diary of his life as an avatar, and as he speaks about trying to learn the Na'vi language, Cameron cuts to his lessons with the fiery female warrior Neytiri, who under all the computer imagery is modeled on actress Zoe Saldana.
This is video log 12 times 21, 32. Do I have to do this now? Like, I really need to get some rec.
No, now, when it's fresh.
Okay, location, shack, and the days are starting to blur together.
Ondu.
The language is a pain, but, you know, I figure it's like field stripping a weapon. Just repetition, repetition.
Na'vi.
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 Doing it stronger.
Neytiri calls me Scown. It means moron.
It's obvious that under the spell of this mystical culture, Jake will go native, and that Avatar will become a fantasy land dances with wolves. Actually, dances with Thanators and Banshees and Dire Horses and Leonopteryxes. But the story would be ho-hum without the spectacle. The problem with computer-generated imagery is it usually doesn't make the final perceptual leap. It's impressive rather than immersive. But Cameron has moved the boundary posts. My press kit mentions, among other inventions, a new image-based facial performance capture, more intricate head rig systems, a simulcam, and an amplified mobility platform suit, or AMP. But Cameron also has old-fashioned compositional savvy. He puts enormous things in the foreground, trees, waterfalls, creatures, and adds layers of texture and movement reaching back into the frame. He creates a living ecosystem, and you and your 3D glasses are there. The technology helps put over the movie's central idea that this world Pandora, with its bioluminescent ground and foliage, is alive and infused with sacred energy. The Na'vi have long waists, reptilian tails, golden eyes, and wide noses. At first, I found them an eyesore, but about halfway through, the humans began to seem puny and pallid by comparison. Jake becomes more attracted to them, too, especially toward the Amazonian Neytiri. He says as an avatar, he's in the true world. It's his human world that's the dream. He says, I don't know who I am. Who he is, of course, is a born-again Indian fighting for the pure and primitive against the poisonous forces of technology, with the help, of course, of state-of-the-art cinematic technology. Clods of dirt fly into our faces. Colors are more colorful. Big beasts, bigger and more bestial. Warplanes, more terrifyingly warlike. Cameron is said to be an obsessive, even a megalomaniac. But I bow to his titanic will. Now, he's king of a world he made from scratch.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.